complicated study. If you conduct a study and you get certain findings or certain results, that is not conclusive scientific data. What needs to happen is that other people, other researchers, need to repeat that study. Replication is repeating a study that was designed and conducted by somebody else in order to see if you get the same results or if they're different. If you conduct a study and you get certain findings, and then some other people, one, two, three, four, five other people, repeat that study and they get either exactly the same or very similar results, each time that happens, it increases the scientific validity of your findings. So somewhere between 85 and 90% of the studies conducted in the field of psychology are replication studies, repeating research that was initially done by somebody else in order to test and see whether you get the same result. A single event doesn't prove anything. Getting the same results over and over can begin to produce conclusive information. Replication. Study is repeating the research by conducted by somebody else to see if you get the same result. We're going to talk more about this later on, but since it was presented today, I think you need to at least have a handle on where we're going with some of our discussion. One of the things that it says in the first chapter of your book is that it talks a little bit about the goals and objectives of psychology, and they are certainly stated to include understanding behavior and those things that give rise to behavior, to be able to predict behavior based on our study of past experience or past events, to be able to predict future behavior, and next, if necessary or desirable, to be able to change or modify behavior. And understanding, prediction, and control or modification of behavior. How do we go about understanding and being able to predict behavior based on past experience, how often something will occur again, or what is the likelihood or the predictability of behavior? Well, we go about that through conducting research in psychology, and that's where we're going with this today. I've listed three of the research methods that I'm going to be talking about in here on the board today. I was unduly optimistic. We're not going to get to all three of these. We'll probably have an opportunity to address the first and maybe to some degree the second of the research methods. And what I've done is to put these on the board and to focus my discussion of these in some kind of a logical progression, an order, on a timeline. So some of these were mentioned, perhaps using other words or other phrasing, in the video that you just saw. But I think it's important for you to know that there is a progression, a process of advancement in psychology by which methods changed as they improved, as they became more sophisticated, more scientifically balanced. But if you go all the way back to the beginning, listen carefully to the words I'm going to use now. Like to see that everybody's back with us. Some people chose the viewing opportunity to catch a little dead eye. And I'm happy to have provided you with the rest period, but I do want to let you know that I'm already working on the first test, and probably somewhere between 6 and 10 are going to come from the video that you have on the inside of your eyelids with the eyelids closed, checking for hair holes, or whether your eyes have been open and you've been assimilating the information and the film was being shown. You're responsible for it, as I said in the beginning. So, if we go back to the beginning of psychology and we take a look at the original methods, the first method used by psychology is called the observational method. It goes back to the idea that psychology is an empirical science. I'm going to say that again. Psychology is an empirical science. That is to say, it's a direct descendant of 18th century British empiricism. That which we can know and learn about is that which we can observe. So the first method that psychology developed and employed was the observational method. That's Roman numeral 1 on the board. Speaking of tests, Just thought I'd pass this along to you. In keeping with my policy of advance warning, not put a negative spin on it, advance notification, I did say to you in the beginning of the semester that tests in here were going to be announced a week to 2 weeks in advance. Consider this a warning shot being fired across the bow. I am working on your first test, and it is almost complete. I would say within 2 weeks or thereabouts, not next week, but maybe Thursday of the following week or Tuesday of the following week. So you have ample time to prepare, and if you haven't hunkered down and gotten your readings done in the book, and if you haven't read the handouts you were given, if you haven't consulted some assistance at the Academic Learning Center for areas in which you may be having some difficulty, get it done. Get it done. The day of reckoning, possibly Thursday of the following week or the Tuesday of the week after that, depending on how much progress you make. I just love test days, because every other day during the semester, I have to come to class prepared. If we have tests, somebody else has to put your number in on that group of people who are prepared to come in and take it. Let's take a look at this observational method over here. Two types, one older than the other. Let us take a look at the older of the two. One that is still, in some instances, still used and used very skillfully. First method used, if we want to know something about behavior, where it occurs, when it occurs, why it occurs, the degree of frequency with which it occurs. One way in which we can go about studying that is to go out into the field. So now we're talking about field research. We go out to where that behavior, and this is where it gets its name, naturally occurs in everyday life. And we study the behavior there. Naturalistic observation, going to where behavior usually or typically or naturally occurs, and studying behavior there. There are some shortcomings of studying behavior in the natural environment. And so, to illustrate one of those, in parentheses next to naturalistic observation, I would like you to put in parentheses participant observation. In order to do that kind of research and that kind of study, you have to go to where the behavior occurs and introduce yourself into the situation that you want to study. Therefore, the minute you do that, you change the situation you wanted to study. Because under normal circumstances, you wouldn't be there. So you've introduced something new into the situation you want to study. That's drawback number one. Participant observation. And the minute you interject yourself into the situation that you want to study, you alter it. It is not the same as it was before, and it is not the same as it would be if you weren't there. Think about it this way. If you want to know something about how kids, young children, adapt to entering the world of school. We say, yeah, well, so what, they enter the world of school. Well, if you think about it from a little bit different perspective, that's the first time that a little kid leaves the protective and particularistic of the environment, the home and the family, a supportive environment, and enters into an entirely new environment. The basis for acceptance of you in that new environment is not that you be love-worthy and reasonably obedient, being cute, having dimples and curly eyelashes, no. But that no longer cuts it. Because the basis for your acceptance in that new environment is no longer to be love-worthy, but to be respect-worthy. The criteria for your acceptance is not whether or not you're nice or cute, but how well can you spell? How fast can you run? How well can you do arithmetic? So being able to be a person who produces things, being able to be a person who is able to comply with direction, and to be a productive person. So what we do is now begin to derive acceptance by demonstrating our competence. competency-based activity. Kids, when they enter the world of school, are not only separated from home for beginning with, I guess, kindergarten or first grade, probably a minimum of 6 hours a day. And for the next 10 years after they enter the school, they are going to be separated from home, parents, and family for longer and longer periods of time each day. And by law, they have to be there until they are 16 years of age in our society. There's no getting away from it. When they enter school, they enter something that is often referred to as the subculture of childhood. The basis for your acceptance among that group is how fast can you run? How much heroism and courage can you demonstrate on the monkey bars in the playground at recess? How skillful are you at playing various childhood games? This subculture of childhood really transmits or passes on its culture from one generation of kids to the next. So in short, kids enter a whole new world. The transition to that world is not always easy. So if you want to study how kids adapt to that environment and to each other, I mean, hell, at home, parents make exceptions for younger kids. They expect more mature and responsible behavior from older kids in the family. Sometimes they say to older kids in the family, I have to run to the store, keep an eye on your brother. I'm going to get a quart of milk and a loaf of bread. I'll be back in 10 minutes. So they tend to delegate responsibility, greater responsibility, to older kids, and they make allowances. They have greater tolerances for younger children, which ticks many of us off, which is why older kids in the family frequently say to their parents, I think you let that kid get away with murder. Yeah, and if I tried that when I was their age, he'd have grounded me for a month. And they're probably right. We're a little more uptight with the first one, we get off the launch pad. After that, we get a little more laid back and mellow and relaxed with each subsequent child we have. And hell, by the time you got four or five, you try to remember to count them when you leave the house so you make sure you got all of them. Mm-hmm. You're lucky to remember all their names, let alone their birthdays, but you remember all that stuff for the first one. That's why there are significant differences between the oldest children and youngest children of the family. Oldest children are more responsible. They are more achievement conscious and achievement oriented. They're more susceptible to anxiety. They also do much more successful work at school and in the world of work, and they much more closely resemble the attitudes and values of their parents. Those young ones over there, they are much more rebellious. They are much more defiant of authority. They sort of march to the rhythm of their own drummer. And they have greater latitude, and therefore they do things at an earlier age than their older siblings did. They are also much more expressive, much more demonstrative, much more affectionate, because when there's a bunch of kids in the house and you're the youngest one and you want a hug, you don't wait for somebody to notice you and give you a hug. You walk over and you stand next to them when they're sitting in the chair and say, I want a hug, crawl up in their lap and make sure they give you one. So they're more assertive in terms of having their affectional or emotional needs met. So there's a lot of difference. Now, when we get to school, the same thing is expected of everybody. All 25 or 27 kids in that room have to conform to the same set of standards and expectations. So in short, it's a hell of a transition. If you want to know about some of those things that I've just described, one way to find out about it is to get yourself, enlist the cooperation of a superintendent of schools, a principal of an elementary school, a cooperating teacher, get signed consent forms to go into the classroom and to observe those kids on the first or second or third day of school, preferably starting with the first day. You can learn a hell of a lot about kids and their personalities by watching them the very first day of school before they even get in the building. Just kind of stand around and watch and see what happens. Make sure you have signed permission. They tend to call the cops on people who hang out in the playgrounds watching Although that's kind of a misconception for the most part. Early on in the kindergarten experience of most children, they have a representative of the local police department come in and they hand out the kids all these little pictures for the kids to color, and the policeman tells them a story about beware of strangers and watch out for strangers and don't accept things from strangers. You give these kids this picture of this guy wearing a trench coat and a Babe Ruth hat clutching a bag of cookies lurking behind a tree on the playground. And while I think that may be an interesting picture for children to color, I happen to know that the statistics are that 85 to 95% of all assaults against children are perpetrated by close personal friends of the family or members of the extended family. So I always told my kids, don't worry about strangers. Don't be alone in the room with Weird Uncle Harold. Now, if you go to the school to make your observations in the classroom, and you've got your clipboard and your pencils and your stopwatch and all your paraphernalia, you go into the classroom, you find yourself a seat in the back of the room, and you try to, as inconspicuously as possible, take notes in the classroom, and you're sitting there on one of those damn little chairs with your knees up around your ears while you're trying to take notes and watch these kids, sooner or later, probably sooner, one of those sharp little kids in the class is going to say to the kid next to him, whoa, get a load of the size of that one. Wonder how many times they've had to go through kindergarten. It must be tough. As soon as you enter the room and start doing what it is you want to do, you change the situation and the interaction process that's going on there. You alter it. So it is participant observation, because you're participating in what it is you want to observe, thereby changing. No getting around it. For that reason, they came up with a second version of observation. And that is called controlled observation. Sometimes also known as structured observation. That is the process by which you bring the observation of behavior into a controlled environment to study it. One which you've designed. One where you can make your observations without being observed or noticed by kids. So you get permission to use some of the empty classrooms here at Union County College. And in one of the rooms, you take out the chalkboard and you replace it with a one-way observation window. In the room, you clear out all the standard furniture. You don't take a lecture hall, you take a regular classroom. Get all the desks and all the chairs and everything out of there. You install wall-to-wall carpeting, lots of throw pillows, lots of tiny little furniture for kids to sit in. You buy yourself a whole bunch of age-appropriate toys for kids that age. You install just the bare minimum that the teacher and the teacher aide needs in order to conduct class in that school, and you arrange for a teacher from the local elementary school to come here and to study the behavior of children. And while they're conducting class in that room with nobody, no outsiders present, you are on the other side of the one-way observation window with videotape cameras running, drop ceiling microphones in here so you can record all that is said and done, and you have at least three observers, not one, but two or three, taking notes on what's going on in that room at all times, and in case they miss anything, they can go to the backup and they can take a look at the videotape and see what happened if they missed anything. Now, it's not going to be the same as if the kids were in their own classroom, in their own school, but it is pretty close to it, and you can do it without being observed or disrupting the interaction process of what it is you want to study. That's called controlled or structured observation. That was considered to be a vast improvement over naturalistic observation. Now, of course, if we're studying animal behavior and you want to know something about the nesting behavior of seagulls or osprey down at the New Jersey shore, and you build yourself a blind and you sit inside there with a camera with a telephoto lens, you can do naturalistic observation, but it's from a distance, and use directional pitch microphones if you want to pick up the sounds that are going on. But in terms of the study of human behavior, more often than not, we use controlled observation or structured observation. Anybody have a question on the observational method? Two types. Those are not two different methods. Those are variations on one method. Observation. Two types, naturalistic and controlled. Question?
Well, you said for the full observational method,
yep,
that you have to bring into a room created by you, into an environment created by you,
yep,
to simulate the environment that you're looking at. How come you couldn't just set up their environment, like maybe put cameras in their environment, put microphones,
can still microphones
in their environment, and
leaving
there and
observing
that
way,
instead of bringing
them to
different places.
The question is, how deep are your pockets? We live in a litigious society, and if you did that in a public school setting, in this or most other states, you could not afford the lawsuits that would ensue as a result of your doing that. So all of the people who are going to participate are going to do so on a voluntary basis, and we are going to have signed consent by each and every parent for them to participate here. Not in the public school where they can shoot the pants off everybody, but here where they're doing it on a voluntary basis in a setting that we have requested permission and obtained from. We may even have a grant in order to do it, to be able to afford all the video equipment and what have you. It's the nature of the beast, it's the nature of our society. And if you think I'm exaggerating, I'm not. There was recently a case that involved a woman who sued the manufacturer of microwave ovens because she gave her toy poodle a bath and wasn't quite dry after she toweled it off. So she put the damn poodle in the microwave oven to dry it off and turned it on. And then ended up suing the manufacturer of the microwave oven and winning the case and was awarded, I'm not kidding you, she got an award of $25,000 for exploding the poodle because it didn't say on the microwave, don't put your dog in here.
Oh, my God.
So you don't want to mess around with doing that kind of experiment in the public school. You want it done off that campus setting. You want it done in an environment like this where everybody signs. You must have parental consent in order to conduct that kind of experiment. So we're going to do it here just to protect ourselves from that kind of insanity.
Besides the mere fact that you have to put a
list
of all the stuff that
you can't
do.
Well, that's what the court suggested. It's being contested, being appealed right now. But the judge who rendered the decision said, hey, if you didn't have a warning label on your microwave, don't put your dog in here to dry it off, you're liable. It's a crazy society.
That is common sense, though.
Yes, I know. You're absolutely right. That's common sense, but that's not the way things run. See, the problem is the world really isn't round. It's sort of misshapen, kind of in a list. Okay, let's take a look at this one. We talk about Dee Stanley Hall in here?
No.
You're right, I guess not. Dee Stanley Hall. A really bright guy who was ahead of his time. Dee Stanley Hall. In the movie that you saw. And he was in the first film that you saw under the heading of the history of psychology. He's going to be on your first test. So maybe we ought to talk a little bit about Dee Stanley Hall. Dee Stanley Hall is the man who established the first experimental laboratory in psychology in the United States of America. The date was 1883. By the way, he's also in the handout I gave you called The Chronological History of Psychology.
He established the first psychology
laboratory in the U.S. At least that's what it says in the handout Professor Sarney gave you. You wrote it. You got it. All right. 1883. He was the head of the psych department at Johns Hopkins University, where he established the first experimental laboratory in psychology. A very bright individual. Only 1900, was the founder and the first president of the American Psychological Association. The APA, the American Psychological Association. That's also in the handout I gave. I tell you, it just warms the cockles of my heart to know that you people are keeping up with your reading. Anyway, he was the founder and the first president of the professional organization for psychologists. At that time, there were so many people getting involved in teaching psychology in various colleges and universities that he decided, that they ought to have a professional organization where they could all get together at least once a year and share information. Talk about who's doing what kind of research, what kind of finding is he coming up with. He's also the guy who said that we should publish psychological journals, and we do. Of all of the things Dee Stanley Hall did, probably the one that stands out the most in people's minds is the fact that, notice the pregnant pause, in 1909, this is the man who brought Sigmund Freud to America. Freud came here for his first and only visit in 1909. By that time, Dee Stanley Hall had moved on from Johns Hopkins, and he was the president of Clark University up in Massachusetts, Worcester, Massachusetts. Brought Freud here, and Freud delivered a long series of lectures, workshops, and seminars. on psychoanalysis. Stayed as a guest in G. Stanley Hall's house at Clark University. They provide the president of that university with a free house on campus. Freud stayed there as a guest. It's still there, rather famous. But for our purposes right now, at this moment, one of the things that I need to mention about G. Stanley Hall is that he is the man who came up with a number of innovative things having to do with research in psychology, because that was his bag, research. He was the first guy to conduct research with a large number of subjects. Up to that time, people conducted their research with one person or maybe a couple of people. He was the first one to run a large-scale research study involving 500 subjects, 500 kids. He was interested in the study of how kids develop, the developmental process. So he wanted to get a large group of kids so he could watch them grow and develop over time, and he wanted to know about kids as they progress through childhood. He's also, by the way, known as the father of child psychology, invented the field. So he got 500 kids, but here was the problem. With the younger children in the study, he could see them as they underwent change, when they accomplished the developmental milestones of being able to sit up and stand and walk, when they spoke their first words, when they were fully toilet trained, when they could feed themselves, etc. But with the older kids in the study, because he wanted to know something about later childhood as well, the 8, 9, 10-year-olds, he couldn't make those kinds of observations. But he still wanted to know what those kids were like when they were young children. So he sat and thought about it and thought about it and finally designed a new research instrument. He called it the questionnaire. It's the first of the survey methods. A series of questions that people respond to. Written out. The questionnaire.
You invented
it. How many of you? Be honest, how many in here have ever gotten a questionnaire in the mail? Something through the mail. Okay. Wow. Okay, good. I want everybody to watch. How many of you mailed it back? Folks, would you please look around the room? That's the problem with the questionnaire.
Mm-hmm.
Take up this questionnaire. You have the questions composed. They're arranged in a particular order. You send it out with a cover letter requesting that people participate. You pay the postage on all the mailings. You buy the envelopes and the rest of the stationery. You arrange for statisticians to put the data when it comes in into the computer for statistical analysis. You mail out the questionnaire. It's like getting a party and nobody comes.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem with questionnaires is the lack of responses. The best that you are going to do if you conduct research using a questionnaire method is less than 50% of the people that you want to sample are going to respond. The best that I know of is about 47%. I get questionnaires constantly from people who are students of psychology or graduate students or people working on their PhD in psychology, and because they teach psychology in a college setting, they have questions about that. So I get them constantly and try to, as faithfully as possible, mail them back. But most people don't. Part of the territory, it comes with my job, so I try to do it. Most people take the questionnaire that they get, and they say, I want to answer that, and they set it on the kitchen counter. And the kid comes along and spills a glass of orange juice on it, and there goes the questionnaire. So after you mail it out the first time, then you compose a second letter, and there's a second mailing of the questionnaire, and it begins by saying, 3 weeks ago we mailed you a questionnaire and we have not yet received your response. Would you please be so kind as to complete the enclosed second questionnaire and return it to us at your earliest possible convenience? They don't mail that one back either. So what you come to the realization is, and I know I used to do some of this kind of research, you've got to send out questionnaires to double the number of people you need in your study, because only half of them are going to respond. Now that gets to be a very, very expensive proposition. Okay, printing up the questionnaires, having the letters reproduced, the envelopes, the stationery, the people to do all that kind of work, and then you got to have the people to analyze the data when it comes in, and so forth and so on. So you're talking about, hey, a pretty costly process. Therefore, a second version of the survey method, not a new method, a variation on this theme, is what's called the structured interview. That's where, instead of sending people questionnaires, You give the questions to trained interviewers, and they go out and ask them of people. Now, I'm not talking about these yebus in Woodbridge Center that as you're walking through the table and try to serve you, and before you say no, they spray it all over you, and you're ready to wrap them. No, I'm talking about calling up people, arranging an appointment in your home, having a person who is a professionally trained interviewer go out and interview the person. Structured interview. There's a specific order in which they ask the questions. They ask them the same way, with the same kind of intonation and tone of voice with each question, because they don't want to lead any of the respondents. Sometimes there are questions that are included, and the next question is determined by how you responded to the previous one. Here's what's interesting. You see these questionnaires? I left out an important thing here. There are people out there in this world who do send back questionnaires. All of them that they get. Those are the people who don't have a life. Their life centers around responding with these questionnaires. And many of them represent what I like to think of as the lunatic fringe of the population of our society. You send them a questionnaire, and the possible responses are yes, no, maybe. They don't like those choices. So they write you a long essay answer to each one of the questions. Very lonely people. There are people who read a question, or I should say misread a question, and they say, oh no, I know what this question's really about. And my sex life is none of their damn business. So they write you a very scalding response to that one and go on to the next one. All of these questionnaires that you do get back from the psychoceramics out there. You know what a psychoceramic is? That's a crackpot. All of the questionnaires you get back from them, you can't use. You've got to throw them out. So there's about a third of the ones you do get back you can't use because it's sent in by the loonies, who write outrageous responses to questions, and you can't use any of that data because it'll entirely screw up your study. So here's what they found. When you have higher trained interviewers, pay them so much an hour, you pay the mileage for the use of their car, you pay their transportation portal to portal from the research facility to the person's home and back again, and you teach them, actually put them through a training program how to do the interviews, now you get much more accurate, much more honest, and much more valid information than you do with a questionnaire. Because people believe that just because they get the questionnaire in the mail and they mail it back, that it's anonymous. I'll bet all of you thought that those anonymous questionnaires were anonymous. I'll get to you. Both. They mailed it to you. They not only know who you are, they know where you live. And there's a barcode on every one of those. So they can specifically pinpoint who it's from. See, they think we're not dealing with a full deck. A year ago, the New Jersey State Department of Education conducted a research survey among all college faculty in the entire state of New Jersey. Princeton, Rutgers, Fairleigh, Drew, Kane, Seton Hall, Union County, Raritan Valley, Middlesex. I got mine. I said, uh-oh, I've got to fill this out. It came in February. I was supposed to have it back by the 1st of April. I put it in the inbox. And on top of that went a bunch of requests for letters of recommendation from my former students who wanted letters of recommendation for a four-year school. And all kinds of, I mean, they bury you in paper when you do the kind of work that I do, if you let them. So I left it there. About halfway through the month of April, there's a knock on my door. Not just Joe Bag of Donuts banging on my door, but a sergeant from campus security. He says, hi, Professor Barney. I said, hi, how are you? He said, you know, back in February, we sent you a questionnaire, and our records show that you haven't responded to that questionnaire. And I was wondering why. I said, oh, you mean that anonymous questionnaire? He said, yeah. I said, well, if it was anonymous, how the hell do you know I didn't send it back? He said, oops. Even among the faculty, they knew who got what. So some of the faculty members were cutting little barcodes off before they submitted them so that nobody knew what their responses were. Yes, they are not anonymous. They know who you are. So if you do get one of these questionnaires and decide, just for the hell of it, you're going to mail it back, be careful what you write. They know who you are, and they may come to get you. Okay. Here's the last one. If you can't do the in-person interview because that was costly, we just jumped from about $15 per subject here to about $35 per subject in your study, which means now you got to apply for a grant because you don't have that kind of money to pay the professional interviewers. So you have to apply to the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the State Department of Education, the Department of Health and Human Services, whatever, to get a grant to do your study. So what did they do? They came up with alternative number three survey method, the telephone survey. The one that you all love. Just as you sit down to eat supper, the phone rings. Hi there. Do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions? Here's what I say. You know, I would really like to respond to your questions, but I'll tell you what. That's impossible right now, but if you give me your home phone number and tell me what time you have supper, I'll be glad to call you back down and answer your question. Very often now, it's not even a person. You're talking to a computer. Okay. That's the telephone survey. It's the last and most annoying one, particularly after you've watched the murder mystery on television. For an hour and 45 minutes, and you're about to find out who did it, and the damn phone rings, and it's one of the telephone surveys. Have a great weekend. That's it for today.